So this is a little bit more complicated a title than the one that was in the information. So, but I wanted to talk to you guys today about a variety of issues that I think are relevant to conceptualizations of mental illness and mental health, and also relevant to issues of diagnosis. And so I'm going to walk you through a critique, I suppose, of those ideas and propose some alternatives. The title, as you no doubt can read, is Illness, Deception, Complexity, and Positive Feedback Loops. Makes a rather strange collection of ideas, but the idea of mental illness and even of illness is actually a relatively strange collection of ideas, so that doesn't really bother me too much. So let's talk, first of all, about problems that you might encounter when you're attempting to determine what a mental illness is. And the first problem is really a technical one, and it's a problem that actually affects you regardless of what you're doing, and it's the problem of categorization. And when you categorize things, you're basically trying to determine, in some sense, how they're the same and how they're different. Although the technical problem comes in that there are an almost infinite number of ways that you can define same, and equally there are almost an infinite number of ways that you can define different. And so when you state that categorization is a matter of identifying similarities and dissimilarities, that actually doesn't take you very far, because it doesn't get to the root of the problem. And part of the root of the problem always is categorization for what. People think that when you categorize things, you're basing your categories on the idea, you know, on the idea of sorting by objective similarity. But actually, when people are active in the world doing things that matter, although they think they're doing that because they've basically been convinced to believe that they think naturally like scientists, they're hardly ever doing that. There are scientific categories, and technically speaking, most of the objects of scientific categories fall into the classical category. And a classical category is like the category of triangles. And the reason the category of triangles is a classical category is because you can precisely define it. There are precise and bounded inclusion and exclusion criteria. And so a triangle has to have three sides and three angles, and they have to sum up to 180 degrees. And if that doesn't happen, then it's not a triangle. And there's no ifs, buts, or maybes, and there's no gray areas. And most of the categories that scientists use when they're doing things that are truly scientific are classical categories, or at least the categories under development are being developed in a way so that they move towards the stature of classical categories. But unfortunately, when you're doing something like psychological work or psychiatric work, what you're doing is actually not science. It's more like engineering, and you could think about it as social engineering, I suppose, given that you're actually trying to accomplish something that has some desirable end. And so the categories that people use when they're trying to accomplish something desirable don't necessarily have to fit classical category structure. So one classic, non-classical category was identified by Wittgenstein as a prototype or a familial resemblance category. And one of the things you'll note if you look at the DSM, for example, is that almost all the categories in the DSM are in fact family resemblance categories. And so the way you have a family resemblance category, I don't know, some of you at the back may not be able to see this picture very well, but we've got four brothers here. And as you may know, three brothers have little triangle-shaped hair, and three of them have blue eyes, and they all have very round faces, and one of them has brown eyes. And they're all members of the same family. And the reason they're members of the same family is because there are a list of attributes of that family. And if any member has perhaps three or more attributes, it's a member of the family. Now, imagine you had a list of 10 attributes, which you might if you looked at a diagnostic category. And then imagine your decision rule is that if you are characterized by any five of those 10, you have the disorder. What that means is that person A could have the first five category descriptors, and person B could have the second five category descriptors. So they don't share any features in common, and yet they're members of the same category. And that's a classic family resemblance category. All the DSM categories are like that. They give you a list of symptoms, and if you have enough of them, you have the whatever it is, illness, disorder, however you want to describe it. Now, that works in psychiatry and psychology because once you start to think about it as a branch of engineering, because the purpose of diagnosis is not generally descriptive. The purpose of diagnosis is generally action predicated, right? You diagnose someone because you want to do something about the fact that they have the diagnosis. And part of the terrible problem that's encountered by researchers in clinical psychology and in psychiatry is that they insist upon assuming that the non-classical categories that characterize psychopathology are in fact classical. And so what that means is they'll gather a variety of subjects into a research pool and assume homogeneity because the diagnostic category is the same for all the members. But there's no homogeneity because the diagnostic category is a family resemblance category, and there are all sorts of subordinate elements associated with that category. It makes doing scientific research into the basis of psychopathology fundamentally impossible, because there's no clear causal pathway to a heterogeneous disorder. And so there's deep philosophical confusion in the clinical and psychiatric literature, and it refuses to go away. Fundamentally, the reason it refuses to go away is because, especially since the late 1800s, psychologists and psychiatrists have attempted to delude themselves into the notion that they are in fact scientists. And they're, insofar as they're clinical practitioners, they aren't, no more than physicians are. And you can't do a proper science without having the proper categories. And the truth of the matter is, and it's plain and simple, is that our categorical structure for psychopathology from a scientific perspective is it's a mess, probably approximately tantamount to the mess of astrological categories. So that doesn't mean, look, that doesn't mean it doesn't work. Like, I'm making a distinction here between something pragmatic and something scientific. You know, I mean, a lot of what psychiatrists and psychologists do is maintain social order. I mean, that was a big part of criticism about psychiatric diagnosis in the 1960s. And, you know, the people in the sort of radical left-wingers of the 60s thought that it was appalling that psychiatrists were involved in maintenance of social order. I don't happen to think it's appalling. I think it's necessary. But I think people should be honest about what they're doing. I mean, because, well, we'll get to it. So here's another problem. Well, I alluded to this before. Why are you categorizing things? Well, one function is descriptive and the other function is action predicated. And this is interesting, too, because people are motivated creatures and they're not running around trying to describe the world. They're running around trying to live, and that's not the same thing. And what that means fundamentally is that our basic categories, perceptual, cognitive, or otherwise, aren't descriptive categories. They're tool-like categories. And what we do naturally, without even ever thinking about it, is divide the world into objects that are useful for us to use. And, I mean, when you guys look at this room, you know, you may think that what you see are objects, but you don't. You see things that are functionally useful to you. There's an infinite number of objects in this room. So if you, you know, were perceiving the objects, you'd just be here all day, you know, staring at things like somebody on LSD. So, and I actually mean that technically, because people who are on LSD and hallucinogens like that lose their ability to screen out stimuli, and they get fascinated by absolutely everything. So when you look around the room, you see chairs and tables and platforms and microphones, and the reason you see those things is because they're useful. It's not because they're objects. It's because they're useful. And you do that naturally. And our psychiatric and psychological categories are very similar. We put people in categories because we want to do things with those people. And sometimes the people want those things done too. You know, I mean, one of the advantages of psychiatric diagnosis that the radical left-wingers of the 60s overlooked is that it's often a tremendous relief to someone who, for example, is suffering from panic disorder to come in to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist not knowing what the hell's wrong with them, and the psychiatrist will say, oh, you have panic disorder, and here's the list of symptoms, and here's, you know, a website with 100,000 other people who have it, and here's a treatment program, and, you know, you're not the only person in the entire world that has this, and we kind of understand it. And the person, although categorized, breathes a great sigh of relief, because now that they know what they have, they also know what they don't have. And believe me, if you have an undiagnosed illness, not knowing what you have is generally a lot worse than knowing what you do have. So I'm not complaining about the fact that mental health professionals use functional categories in their approach to mental illness. It's perfectly reasonable, but you have to be clear about what you're doing. So let's look at, we'll take this apart philosophically, right? We'll do this in the Socratic manner. It's like, so if we're talking about mental illness, we should start by talking about illness. Well, what is illness? Well, on the right left-hand side, there's a square there. You can't see it very well. Illness. What's illness related to? Pathogen. That might be the simplest explanation, although you're so full of bacteria that it's absolutely ridiculous. So that's a kind of, you actually have about 10 times more bacteria in your body by number than you do human cells. So the mere, yeah, I know it's a terrible thought, but, but you know, the mere presence of pathogens doesn't indicate illness, but some illnesses are accompanied by, you know, an exceptional overload of a certain kind of pathogen. Those are illnesses that are pretty easy to identify in some ways or to conceptualize. So that's one potential marker of an illness. You're colonized by some parasitical organism. Another marker we use for illness is suffering, right? We generally presume two things. We assume that if you're suffering, there's probably something wrong with you, or if you're really making other people suffer, there's probably something wrong with you too. And there's a subset of those two occurrences that we might regard as characterized by illness, although we tend not to think that every form of suffering is an illness. Although in the DSM, bereavement, I believe, now is defined as a psychiatric disorder. And there's some, you know, there's some utility in that. And it's understandable, even though you could make a case against it. So suffering matters. So we tend to think that there's something wrong with undue pain and anxiety. Maybe undue disgust. Mostly it's associated with negative emotion, right? We don't like too much negative emotion. But now and then we also consider too much positive emotion pathological. So that's what happens, for example, in the case of mania. So the excessive domination by an emotional state, mostly suffering, but not always, is one of the criteria by which we might judge illness. Then there's another one, which you might think of functional interference. There was a special journal of the Journal of Abnormal Psychology published quite a while ago now, about 15 years, that was devoted to conceptualizations of mental illness. And the paper that probably had the most impact in that journal was, and I unfortunately can't remember the name of the author, he claimed that a system was pathological if it was no longer performing its biologically designed function. And, you know, that's stupid, because things don't have biologically designed functions, because biology doesn't design functions. Right? It's not teleological. You can attribute a function to a biological system, but you have to do that. You're inferring it. But he was still on, like, what function does your hand have, right? What function does your tongue have? It's not easy to figure these things out, because there are multiple functions, and some of them seem good and some of them bad. You can't skirt the issue by pointing to evolution and using it as your whipping boy for poor philosophy. So, well, people do that all the time. When they don't want to think something through, they blame it on evolution. It's not helpful. It's not helpful. Now, but the idea of functional interference is helpful, but you gotta understand that your moral judgment plays a role as soon as you make those functional inferences. So what you have to do is specify what you believe to be the goal of a given system, and then define what you consider unacceptable deviance from the pursuit of that goal. And we do that a variety of ways. We allow individual conceptualizations of mental illness. And the paper that probably had the most impact in that journal was, and I unfortunately can't remember the name of the author, he claimed that a system was pathological if it was no longer performing its biologically designed function. And, you know, that's stupid, because things don't have biologically designed functions, because biology doesn't design functions. Right? It's not teleological. You can attribute a function to a biological system, but you have to do that. You're inferring it. But he was still on, like, what function does your hand have, right? What function does your tongue have? It's not easy to figure these things out, because there are multiple functions, and some of them seem good and some of them bad. You can't skirt the issue by pointing to evolution and using it as your whipping boy for poor philosophy. So, well, people do that all the time. When they don't want to think something through, they blame it on evolution. It's not helpful. It's not helpful. Now, but the idea of functional interference is helpful. But you gotta understand that your moral judgment plays a role as soon as you make those functional inferences. So what you have to do is specify what you believe to be the goal of a given system, and then define what you consider unacceptable deviance from the pursuit of that goal. And we do that a variety of ways. We allow individuals to do that. So they might come in and say, I want to do X, but this is happening and I can't, and that's making me suffer. And so you think, okay, you've got a psychological problem. Or maybe a family brings in their 12-year-old daughter, 12-year-old son, who's, you know, causing a tremendous amount of problem at school. And they say, well, you know, we can't control our son, and so we believe there's something wrong with him. And so then you assume that the family's making some sort of reasonable judgment about the appropriate goals of their son plus the family. Then we allow society to do this because normally you can't rob a bank, right? And, you know, maybe we consider that criminal, but under some circumstances we might also consider it a form of illness. And we do a very bad job of differentiating between those because childhood conduct disorder and antisocial personality disorder, both medical syndromes, but you can't segregate them from criminal behavior with any ease whatsoever. So that's a very, very messy and loose category. But the point is that we allow systems at different levels of analysis to specify their goals and then engage in a collaborative discussion about what constitutes unacceptable deviations from the pursuit of those goals. And we might combine those, you know, and we say, well, if you're happy, even if you're failing, well, then you don't have a mental illness. But if you're failing to pursue your goals and that's causing you suffering, that's even more indication that something has gone wrong. Now, you can see right off the bat that's a real vicious problem from a scientific perspective, because as soon as you start to define a goal as valid rather than just as a goal, then you're into ethics and not into science, because valid is a proxy for something like good, right? So, and people don't like to do that, because as soon as they're in the ethical domain, they're not in the scientific domain, and then they can't think of themselves as scientists and everything gets complicated. So, okay, now we'll flip from illness, we'll talk about health. Health is equally problematic, obviously. I'm sure somebody's already talked about normative function, right? I could define you as healthy insofar as you're near the midpoint on some normal distribution, right? And then maybe you could think about health as attempting to tap people towards that midpoint. Most of that's rubbish, too, fundamentally, because at least in terms of an overarching theory, and maybe we can't have a theory of mental illness. Maybe we have to have six theories. You know, theories are tools anyway, so that doesn't bother me too much. But assuming we're trying to come up with a theory, normative doesn't work. First of all, if you look at trait personality, there's a normal distribution. Well, the distribution is a normal distribution, not because the midpoint is normal, but because the normal distribution is normal. And so you're normal wherever you are on that distribution. It's just that there aren't necessarily that many of you. And so, you know, we might object to someone who's pretty high in predatory aggression, which would make them low in agreeableness from a trait perspective, because, you know, they're not that kind. But, you know, if your tribe is being attacked, you probably want to have some predatory aggressors in your little group, because otherwise you'll get slaughtered. And so, you know, maybe you might think then that the sanity issue is a matter of fit between temperament and situation, rather than, you know, temperamental deviation per se. You know, and you might think that empathy and sympathy and all those things are good, but if you are a fan of Freud's Oedipal theory, the first thing you realize, if you know anything about trait theory, is that Oedipal families are characterized by at least one parent who is way too sympathetic and empathetic, right? They don't set any limits and they forgive everything, and that's pathological beyond belief. You can kill people with excess kindness just like you can kill them with excess aggression. So the normative argument doesn't work. Plus, we think more intelligence is better, and we think more beautiful or more symmetrical is better. And so a lot of the times when we're talking about health, normative doesn't work, because we actually have a scale that goes from bad to good rather than from, you know, abnormal to normal to abnormal, which is what a normal distribution does. So we're not going to get out of the issue that way. And then, you know, most of the time, too, when we are talking about health per se, we do have a kind of ideal in mind, right? And that ideal would be the healthy person. And that pops up all the time in psychopathology, abnormal psychology, and in psychology. As soon as it disappears, someone reinstates it. So, you know, Freud maybe concentrated on psychopathology to a large degree. Jung, by contrast, concentrated on individuation, which was a form of moral development as a marker of mental health. Biomedical people, and I guess that really got its start probably started mostly in the 50s or the 40s, probably partly because of the medicalization of psychiatry, but also partly because of the behavioral movement. And that was sort of characterized as another concentration of psychopathology as something like biological dysfunction, brain disorder, or maybe neurotransmitter malfunction. But at the same time that was happening, you had the existential psychotherapists who concentrated on authentic existence as a marker of health. And then after that, you had the humanists and in the 1960s and the phenomenologists who also concentrated on something like truth and authenticity as a marker of health. And then more recently, you have the positive psychologists who are deluded enough to believe that happiness is a hallmark of mental health, which has got to be the stupidest theory that's come out in the last, I would say, probably 2,000 years. So, and they, you know, and just to put the knife in a little deeper, they haven't read any of the existentialists or the humanists or anybody in the last 100 years who talked about, you know, optimal functioning as a marker of mental health and feel that they've invented the concept themselves, which is appalling beyond belief. But anyways, the point is that, you know, there's always been a tension between the definition of pathology as something like medical malfunction and the conceptualization of health as an ideal that's on the other end of that that also has something to do with moral endeavor in one form or another. And I actually think that the morality element of that is difficult to conceptualize from a scientific perspective, but just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's impossible. And I think there has been some interesting move in that direction by people like Piaget, because Piaget had a pretty good conceptualization of the ideal state as something that you could describe technically at the level of systems interaction. And I'll talk to you a little bit about that later. Point here is that you can't make this a simple question by talking about illness or by talking about health, because you run into the same sorts of problems at both ends of the definitional spectrum. Okay, well, now let's think about mental illness more specifically. We already talked about biological disturbance. Now, the biomedical people like to think that, you know, they're kind of like psychoanalysts in a way. Because the psychoanalysts like to think that if there's something wrong with you, it was in your head. And your head would either be your brain or your psyche, because both of them fit uncomfortably in the same skull. And but the point, the thing that makes the psychoanalysts and the biomedical guys similar is that if there is a problem that an individual is manifesting, they tend to localize the not only the source of that problem, but the causal pathways that cause the problem inside the individual. And the biomedical people would point to the utility of psychoactive drugs in the treatment of pathology as proof for their hypotheses. But the problem with that, as we'll see later, is that many of the drugs that the psychobiologists use are so nonspecific in their effects that they treat things that have nothing to do with the individual, even if they're given to the individual. And we'll see how that can sort itself out later. And if you're thinking about psychological disturbance, well, that makes it complicated, too, because you've got a levels of analysis problem, right? I mean, are you talking about disturbance in cognition? Well, then you have to define that. Like, you know, the cognitive behaviorists like to think that the reason people are ill is because they think wrong. Well, that implies that you can think right. That's hard. But it also implies that thought is the primary causal nexus in the relationship between health and illness, intrapsychically, right? So it's in the person and it's thought-based. It's like, so it prioritizes thought to a massive degree, and I don't think that's biologically tenable. I would love it if I could control myself by thinking, but I can't do it, and I doubt like hell any of you can either, even if you're healthy. So cognition is probably privileged too much by cognitive behavioral therapists. There's definitely emotional disturbances. You can think about them biologically. You can think about them functionally. You can think about them at different levels of analysis. There's something key about emotional disturbance to our folk conception of mentally ill. You can have motivational issues. They're linked fairly tightly with emotional problems. I like to think about motivations as goal-establishing functions and emotions as goal-pursuit regulation functions. It's kind of a heuristic, because there's no firm division between the two categories at a biological level. But people can definitely have problems in what looks like motivation. So manics, they're too motivated. If you watch Charlie Sheen lately, you can see that, because he's manic. And, you know, he's extraordinarily expansive, and he's very, very positive and alert and gregarious and active. But, you know, the calibration is off, and that's not so good. And then depressed people, they lose motivation completely. And that is associated with all sorts of cognitive abnormalities, technically speaking, but that doesn't mean that they cause them. Perceptual aberrations also emerge in psychopathology. You see that with schizophrenia, for example. You also see it with conditions like anorexia, where, you know, the anorexics seem to be unable to perceive their own bodies properly. Certain neurological conditions can cause abnormalities in perception as well. And so those are all, even though those categories themselves are problematic because they're basically folk psychology categories, there's no stringent distinction between them biologically, say. But you can see why the diagnostic enterprise is difficult, because each of those different levels of analysis, imprecise as they are, do point to different phenomena. And trying to identify which of those is primary and where the primary dysfunction is exceptionally difficult. Exceptionally difficult. You know, and so, you know, the family systems people localize pathology in the family. And they think about the individual as a unit in a dynamical system that's composed of the family. And I have clients who are nowhere near as insane as their family is, but they're the people who've been targeted with the mental illness because that's convenient for everyone involved, right? It's really annoying if all six of you are crazy because, you know, you're never going to get out of that. So it's often convenient to identify the noisiest complainer as the psychopathological individual and to, you know, scapegoat them. And then, of course, they look like they're ill, too, because they're so bloody stressed that they fall apart in four different ways. But the locale of the problem actually isn't in them, even though they're part of the system that's not functioning properly. And even though you can make them feel better by giving them antidepressants, well, at least sometimes, and that's because they have nonspecific effects. And then you can think about social disturbance. You know, let's say you're depressed, and then I find out, well, the reason you're depressed is because you're unemployed, because that's a big deal for depression. Then I found out the reason that you're unemployed, maybe you lost your pension. Let's do that instead. That depresses you because you're 65 and now you don't have a pension. And then I find out that the reason you don't have a pension is because, you know, you were a victim along with another 100,000 people of some bloody Enron scam. And then you localize the cause of the pathology in the social corruption that exists in the collusion between high-end crooked business leaders and politicians. And so you're part of that system, and too bad for you. But the causal pathway isn't intrapsychic, again, even though antidepressants might treat it. So level of analysis is a deadly, deadly problem. Then you have this additional problem of the relationship between mental illness and creativity, right, or even of abnormality per se. How do you distinguish someone who's creative from someone who's mad? Well, I don't know exactly. Because most creative people produce things that don't work very well and that drive them half mad while they're trying to, you know, market them, let's say, or to get other people to pay attention to them. Creativity is a rough road, and most of the time it's not that good for the person who's engaged in it, you know, even though it might be really interesting to pursue. So here's a tentative partial solution. You can think about this. Mental illness is the inability to regulate perception, action, emotion, cognition in accordance with desired values. Now, that's an interesting one because it's half ethical, desired values, and it's sort of half descriptive, inability. Classical conceptions of mental pathology are really predicated on this viewpoint. So, for example, the classical notion of sin. Sin is a word derived from another word, hamartia, in Greek. Hamartia is sin in Greek. And hamartia means to miss the target. And that's really, really lovely, because much of what you did on this viewpoint. So, for example, the classical notion of sin. Sin is a word derived from another word, hamartia, in Greek. Hamartia is sin in Greek. And hamartia means to miss the target. And that's really, really lovely, because much of what you do see in psychopathology is a form of missing the target. Now, it's complicated because sometimes you see people in therapy who don't have a target. But that's one way of missing it, right? Is you close your eyes, you don't know where it is. Another way is you don't aim at it, right? Another way is you shoot yourself with the arrow, you know, and then get people to feel sorry for you. But it all does have something to do with this notion of not hitting the target. I like this a lot because human beings, like, we have a hunting biological substructure. We're hunting animals like chimpanzees, and we're really good at tracking moving targets, and we're really good at organizing our behavior in relationship to moving targets, so we can throw rocks at things really well, we can throw spears, and it's on that underlying psychobiological architecture that evolved that our cognitive systems evolved, and our cognitive systems basically track abstract goals that are target-like and aim us at them. And you see this not only in our day-to-day life, where we pursue abstract goals, for example, pursue them, right, which is also what you do with an animal that's running away or a potential mate, you pursue them. Most of our positive emotion is felt in relationship to the pursuit, and the abstracted categories that we use to aim at are targets. And so you could say, in a sense, that mental illness is a consequence of pathology in the goal determination and pursuit systems. And that's a pretty comprehensive one. The advantage to the definition, too, is that it allows the goals to emerge as a consequence of cognitive and moral operations at multiple levels of analysis. You can have some goals, but your goals will be modified by your familial goals, and those will be modified by social goals. So there has to be a balance between the systems that you're involved in that set goals in order for you to be able to pursue any with any degree of emotional stability. And so the balancing issue is very important, too. It's not only that you pursue goals. It's that the goals you pursue have to be of the type, for example, that also allow other people to pursue their goals. And that makes the goals that you're allowed to pursue of a very special sort. And we know this, if you know anything about, you know, the idea of philosophy of human rights. You have your rights end where mine begin. What does that mean? You can set your goals and I can set mine. And if there's a conflict, well, then we have to negotiate. There's something we have to do. All of English common law, by the way, is a consequence of precisely that negotiation. Because the initial hypothesis is you have all the rights there are and so do I. But when we clash, there has to be a superordinate determination of goal priority. And that's English common law. So and that relates to that idea of Piaget, as I talked about earlier. Because Piaget thought about an ideal state as one where goal pursuits were equilibrated. So imagine that, I don't know, maybe you're really good at reading and I'm really good at writing. And so we decide to collaborate on a paper. Well, that's great. That's an equilibrated state because you get to pursue your goals. You're really good at them. Wonderful. I get to pursue mine. I'm really good at them. We throw that together in a collaborative pursuit, which means we subordinate our goal seeking to a higher order goal, and the higher order goal gets accomplished, and so do both our goals. Yes. Perfect. And that's called an equilibrated state. And when I talked about the idea that science might be able to start to understand idealized goal structures using this Piagetian approach. The Piagetian approach basically assumes that as we mature and become increasingly social, our internal singular goal-directed systems start to cooperate under the influence of the cortex, essentially. And then once that's happened and there's integration to some degree inside, then we can start integrating our higher order integrated goal structures with those of other people. And we keep doing that over longer and longer time frames and including more and more people. And there's a balance there. And that balance is an equilibrated state. And if you operate in it keeping with that balance, then you're mentally healthy. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that, but it's not a bad start. It's a brilliant idea. So here's some consequences of this. First of all, you could think about, let's think about some forms of mental illness. One goal is not good enough. You can't be just hungry. That's not going to work. Now, you could have a certain kind of hypothalamic malfunction that would only make you thirsty, say. What will happen then is you'll drink water till you die. And that does happen to people. And because the hypothalamus is the root of extremely powerful biological motivations. But there's a bunch of them. And so what that means is they have to learn how to operate competitively and cooperatively in order for the entire organism to survive. And if the organism is reduced to any one of those single motivations, then pathology will emerge. Okay, well, let's think about anorexia here. These is from a pro-anorexia website. There's lots of those. This is a celebrity who's been photoshopped to be anorexic. And anorexia is a consequence of, actually, it looks like it's something like a consequence of excessive will, voluntary will, something like that. But it's the reduction of the entire value system to a single value, thin, period, no matter what. And that carries with it its own morality, by the way, its own value judgments, its own perceptions, its own actions, its own emotions. Like, it's a full-fledged personality to be an anorexic. The one on the right there is an anorexic woman in a bikini. And from an anorexic's point of view, that's pretty beautiful, because anorexics, they like bones. They're not so happy with skin and flesh, but they're pretty happy with bones. So, now, So the way I presented an anorexic, let's say, is it's like one of those one-eyed monsters, one of those things, cyclops in mythology. A cyclops thinks one thing. A cyclops is like a giant penis, by the way. I mean, from a symbolic perspective, it's the same idea, because it's usually something masculine and single-minded. Okay, so, and the idea is that masculine, single-minded thing is a personality that's dominated by a single motivational state. And that makes it extremely powerful and giant-like, but also kind of blind and lumbering, right? Because it only wants one thing, and that's like a two-year-old, you know? It's not very bright. So now you might ask yourself, how might a personality like that come about? So I'm going to tell you a quick story about addiction, all right? So this is one that's worth knowing. So a guy named Norm White, about 1989, separated the idea of reward and reinforcement out. Reward feels good. That's basically what happens when you're pursuing something. Or when you catch it. You like pursuing better because you're human, but catching things is not so bad either. And if you pursue something successfully, what happens is that your brain produces dopamine as a consequence of the markers of your success. Now, the dopamine has a biological function. Now, imagine this. What the dopamine does is it looks at your brain structures and it says, let's make the structures that were operating while we were doing this pursuit grow. That's reinforcement. And then you might ask, well, what do you mean by operating during this pursuit? I mean, let's say you're trying to date someone. You've been doing it for 5 years. So which circuits are activated just before you do it? Well, a whole bunch of them. Complex, complex, complex circuits. So imagine every time you pursue something, there's a sequence of circuitry that's operative, and that as you're successful, the dopamine reinforces those circuits, with the ones temporally closest being reinforced more, so they grow, but the ones farther back also being reinforced. Now, think about it this way. So, you're a methamphetamine addict. Well, when you start out, you're not an addict. You're just someone who's bored to death, or somewhat self-destructive, or some combination of both. Doesn't matter. So, what happens when you decide to take methamphetamine? Well, the first thing you need is a nice set of rationalizations, right? You got to think, what the hell? Or you got to think, I'm too drunk to know better. Or you got to think, the future's not worth living anyways. Or you have to think, to hell with this. Any of those will do. And so you think those, and then you act, and you take the methamphetamine, and it wallops you with the dopamine hit, and exactly those circuits grow. So then you might ask yourself, what happens if you activate the cognitive circuit that's associated with the future doesn't matter, and to hell with it, 10,000 times. Then you have a little devil in your head that's a full-fledged personality. It has a very nihilistic viewpoint. The viewpoint is to hell with it, which is not a good viewpoint to adopt. And it's massive after you've hit it 1,000 times with methamphetamine. And so the you that used to be, you'll still be there when you're not craving. But as soon as you get sight of something that's associated with methamphetamine, that little monster that you grew inside your head, which is one of these cyclops, it's going to pop up and shut the rest of you down. And so that's not so good. And so the addiction isn't a behavior that's manifested in response to a cue, and it's not craving. It's the manifestation of a full-fledged, one-dimensional personality with its own perceptions, emotions, motivations, and cognitions that wants one thing and does not care about anything else. Well, maybe it also cares about the other things that you think to hell with, because, you know, that's in the associated cognitive web. So that's what grows. So there's 10 years of meth use in the top left-hand corner. And so you can see that the person's well-being is pretty much sacrificed entirely to the demands of the drug. Methamphetamine is a vicious dopamine agonist, right? So it operates very rapidly, and that's one of the things that makes something addicting. But addicting is complicated. Addicting means that it grows an addicted personality in your head. That's why it's so hard to get unaddicted. It's not just a matter of getting rid of the craving. That's nothing. You can put someone in a cell for 3 days, and they won't. Like, they won't be going through withdrawal anymore. They won't crave as long as they're there. Show them one of their meth friends, boy, the craving's back because that system's in their head and it's alive. Now, older, more archaic people were a little more intelligent than us, accepting the psychoanalysts, because they knew that most of the pathological things that happen to us are like personalities. So here's one in the bottom right. That's the devil of liquor. Well, what does liquor have in it? A spirit. Right. And what's the spirit? Well, the spirit's Dionysius, of course, or Bacchus. And so when you drink the spirit that's in alcohol, you're opening yourself up fundamentally to something like possession by a Dionysius. Of course, you like that because Dionysius is a very short-term pleasure-seeking, sort of lustful type of subpersonality. And you got to repress that most of the time because, you know, it's not very sightly. But if you drink enough wine, whoa, you know, fun. You can do all the stupid things that really give you a dopamine kick but aren't so good for you in the long run. So, and it's best to think about that as a personality. So here's something interesting you may or may not know. Medieval people, when they talked about the seven deadly sins, so that's seven deadly ways to miss the target, right? They personified each of the sins, which I love because it's so sophisticated. It's far more sophisticated than the way we conceptualize mental disease because we think of the brain as a, you know, a subset of something like robotic cognitive circuits. It's like, no, wrong. You're a collection of personalities, subpersonalities, loosely ruled by you. But all those subpersonalities, those are bloody powerful forces. And they're not just cognitive circuits. They have their own viewpoint. And I really mean that. Like, they see the world a particular way, which is the way you see the world when you want to have sex, or when you're hungry, or when you're thirsty, or when you're angry, or when you want revenge, or whatever. Those are real things, and they're not little circuits. They're alive, and you can make them grow and dominate. So this is pride. Pride is the thing that makes you think you know everything. And it's associated with a descent into hell. That's good. That makes a lot of sense. When I get to the bottom of my clinical client's pathology, and this is for people who are really suffering, there's usually the things that I find at the bottom are usually one of two or both. One is pride. The people, especially the people who have something like personality disorder, they bloody well think that they can get away with tricks and that no one is smart enough to figure it out. And if they don't think that, a family member thinks it. And so it's appallingly arrogant. Appallingly. Another thing that's often at the bottom is resentment, which is this notion that life is terrible, you know, generally speaking, but it's terrible for me in a specific way in that I've been picked out for a particular form of unjust misery. And that allows me to be righteous in my anger and to torture people half to death. You get a good combination of resentment and arrogance going. You can be sure that you'll end up in something that is pretty much indistinguishable from hell and also that feels like it lasts for an eternity. Yeah. And then there's avarice. Well, 2008 pretty much, you know, is our lesson for that. That's narrowing of the value structure to a specific kind of greed-like pursuit, right? And why is it wrong? Well, it's because you sacrifice everything else of value to it. And you lose the balance, and then you lose the equilibrated state. Not good. Lust, that's a lovely drawing. I like it a lot because it kind of indicates this sort of animal-like nature, which, of course, is what you'd expect for sexual arousal, right? It's an massively archaic biological force. And it's transpersonal, too, because, you know, you all partake in it, but it's superordinate to everyone, of course. So, envy, sloth, gluttony, all with their own associated devil. Lovely, lovely symbolic representations, dreamlike representations, really. And if you do analysis of people's dreams, when they're suffering from one form or another, you often find representations in the dreams that are, you know, vaguely reminiscent of, sometimes not so vaguely either. I had a psychotic client once who had, you know, vaguely reminiscent of, sometimes not so vaguely either. I had a psychotic client once who had been doing immunological research at McGill, and he was under a lot of pressure because his older brother was a doctor, another one was a lawyer, a lot of second generation immigrant, you know, what do you call, ambition pressure in his family. He couldn't get his master's degree to work properly, so he faked it out and handed in the thesis. And that night he woke up and saw the devil sitting at the foot of his bed, and that was when he disintegrated into a psychotic state. Now, you know, you can explain that biologically, no problem, I think, because, you know, it sounds kind of like a little bit of an epileptic episode induced by stress or something like that. But the phenomenology is part of the experience, too. And those things are a lot more common than you'd think. There's anger. That's resentment most specifically. See, and this is Satan right here, thrown out of heaven. And he's trapped in ice, which I really like because he's immobile and cold. So he can't move. And the reason he can't move is because he's plotting revenge, essentially. And to see someone in a state like that really is awful. This is from Shakespeare. You might think about it as the credo of personality that's trapped by vengeful anger. Why should wrath be mute and fury dumb? I am no baby, I, that with base prayers I should repent the evils I have done. 10,000 worse that ever yet I did would I perform if I might have my will. If one good deed in all my life I did, I do repent it from my very soul. Yeah, well, you don't hear psychiatric diagnosis of that sort very often. But you see it a lot more often than you'd think. You know, because I see in my clients certainly suicidal impulses that are destructive beyond belief, but also equally frequently homicidal impulses, you know, and generated for all sorts of reasons. Ugly situations. More on conception of mentally health. Mental health. Let's see here. What have I got for time? I want to talk a little bit about self-deception. All right, so let's talk about mental health. One of the things that I've noticed also about psychiatric and psychological diagnosis, this isn't so true when you think about work mostly done in the 1950s by the existentialist psychotherapists, and this was sort of in the aftermath of World War II when people were particularly concerned with moral choice. The existentialists were very interested in authenticity and inauthenticity as markers of health and illness, you know, respectively. And to me, that's very much reminiscent of Freud's distinction between whatever the opposite of repression is and repression. And the problem is, I think to some degree, both of those groups of thinkers were sort of mealy-mouthed about the real issue. Because Freudian repression is actually something like deception. It's something like a lie. And, you know, Freud didn't use words that bald because they're so contaminated, in a sense, with ethical judgment. But repression is, at minimum, the attempt to not be conscious about something you could be conscious about. And it might interest you to know that under English common law, that's a crime. So if you're a CEO, for example, and you suspect that your chief financial officer might be cooking the books, so that bothers you, you know, affectively, but you decide, well, as long as I don't look at the damn books, you know, that won't be a problem, you're criminally liable for that if you get exposed, because the English common law system presumes that you have an ethical obligation to be conscious of the things that you do that aren't appropriate that you could be conscious of. So in Freud's repression, you know, to some degree, there's ethical discussion about it. That happens more particularly in Jung. But the ethical aspect of it is distinctly underplayed. And you see the same thing with existentialist authenticity versus inauthenticity. Let's make it stark. One is a form of lying and the other isn't. It's as simple as that. And lying really makes a big difference to people. And it's really underdiagnosed as a cause of psychiatric disorder. You know, it's very... Let's assume that you're biologically fragile, which is true. You're all biologically fragile. If I push you hard enough, you're going to blow out at your genetically determined weakest point. So fine, we can all live with that. The question is, how could I most appropriately go about stressing you? And that's pretty simple. Betraying you, that's really works like a charm. You know, I can set you up to trust me for maybe 5 years or so and then just cut you off at the knees. That'll really do you in at your weak point. You know, or I could just fill you with lies from like day one. That's a good one too. You know, or I can also do whatever I can to make myself not conscious of things I should be conscious of. So, you know, maybe I'll just decide if you're my child not to pay attention to your misbehavior. You know, or I could punish you for everything you do that's good. That's a useful thing, too, while telling you all the time that I actually love you. And those things are really, really hard on people. And you don't see much discussion about that in psychiatric, especially the sort of biomedical end of things. You know, it's as if people live in a moral vacuum and all the things that happen to them are biological and objective. It's like that's complete rubbish. Virtually everybody I see in my clinical practice is caught in some sort of ghastly ethical nightmare. You know, I mean, the odd person is trying to improve from a pretty good position. That's a different issue. But people who come in because they're pushed to the limit of their tolerance is like, they're in situations that are so ethically uncomfortable that it's nightmarish. It really is. You know, and that's not merely a matter of biological malfunction. It most often has nothing to do with that. So, let's see. There's a famous paper by Shelley Taylor and Jonathan Brown on, it's quite the paper. It's the most cited paper in social psychology. It's predicated philosophically on the idea that life is so miserable at its fundamental essence that you have to use positive illusions or self-deceptions in order to be mentally healthy enough to, you know, survive. So that's a pretty appalling claim to begin with. But it's also weak philosophically, and I wanted to point out one of the reasons why, in relationship to discussions of mental health. Taylor and Brown claim that most psychologists believe that you're mentally healthy if your perception of reality corresponds to what is actually there. So that's from Yehuda and another, who Taylor and Brown cites, famous summary of studies of mental health. Mentally healthy perception means a process of viewing the world so that one is able to take in matters one wishes were different without distorting them to fit those wishes. So you might think about mental health as the capacity to perceive things, objective things, accurately, but we know there's a big problem with that. The problem is, you can't tell what is there. It's too complicated. And so whatever mentally healthy means has to mean something other than seeing what is there. Because you can't see what is there. What you see, and I mean see, is your best perceptual guess at what's there. And, you know, you have a vision of the future, which is also a guess. And you use both of those to justify your behavior. You know, so you're surrounded by ignorance. Your perceptions and your wishes are never accurate. And they can't be. Because you're not smart enough and things are too complicated. So the idea that mentally healthy means you see what's there is way too simple to be true. Plus, we don't really know what's there. I love this picture. It's a great picture, as far as I'm concerned, of what's there. So this is a medieval picture. You can't see it very well, but it's such a great picture. And so what around the outside? So in the middle there, that's the Virgin Mary, right? So you just think about that as Mother. All right. Now Mother is standing on a little snake dragon thing, and I like that because that is what mothers do. Right? If you think about our species from a biological perspective, you know, one of the things that the mother does is protect the child, the infant, who she's holding there, from predatory aggression, and symbolized in this picture by this sort of predatory serpent that she's standing on. So that's cool, and that little serpent is associated with the moon and with darkness. So the mother protects the child from the serpent and darkness. Yeah, that's right. And then around the outside, this is so cool. Around the outside, in this particular representation, all those things you can't really see are musical instruments. And all these things here, these are all musical instruments. And so this is sort of like reality is the mother and the infant protected from the predator against the background of something like cosmic harmony, which is bloody perfect. And the reason I'm showing you this is just to show you that it is very difficult to see what's there. Because this image is a kind of perception of a level of reality that you can't see, but that's more there than what you do see. It's more true than what you actually see, which is really, in some sense, what makes it archetypal. Now, I'm telling you that for a specific reason that has to do with what makes people mentally healthy. Now, you can think about this as chaos. Now, the whole discussion about deception and authenticity in relationship to psychopathology has been very complicated by one thing, as far as I can tell. And that thing that it's complicated by is the notion that when people lie, the way they do it is by telling someone something they know to be untrue. And you can think about that as a sin of commission. Okay, a sin of commission is when you know that you're doing something wrong. You're actually doing it, and it's wrong. But there's a different kind of way to miss the mark, and this is what people do all the time, and this is what does them in. And I think this is at the root of most psychopathology, and maybe a lot of illness that isn't directly attributable to the interplay with biological weakness. So, and it's hard to explain because people don't think this way. All right, so let's see, how can I explain this? This is, all right, I have this client. She said she had this experience a week ago. That was, she knows a fair bit about theology because she was a religious student at McGill. And she compared what happened to her to Paul being struck dead, the story of Paul being struck dead by a vision in Acts. Now, this is what happened to her. She has one of these families that's so bloody pathological that it's nightmarish. And it's partly because of the social influences, because in her particular culture, the rule for women is shut up and be useless. And that's not a very good rule if you want people to develop healthily, although it's a very, very common rule in many cultures. And so that's one of the cultural rules. And then the rule in her family at the moment, because she's tangled up with her mother and her sister, is something like, nothing that happens to you can be furthered by your own efforts. You have to rely on God, and He'll deliver no matter what. And so that means that if you ever try to do something, you're just being foolish. And if you ever do something, we should punish you half to death because you're trying to disprove our existential theory. And so this poor girl has been punished nonstop since she was born, every time she did something that was useful. It's just unbelievable. And doing something in this household is so difficult that it's a miracle. You just couldn't imagine it. So anyways, we've been trying to get to the bottom of this bloody horrible mess for years, really. And she's never been able to stand up to her mother or her sister. But she finally did 2 weeks ago and told them that they had been involved in this collusion that was designed to make her the source of all pathology in the whole family, and that had been going on for about 40 years. And so that was quite the meeting, as you might imagine. It was a little on the harsh side. And I felt pretty good after that, surprisingly enough, even though it was so awful. But she's having a rough time, eh? Because she finally used the word abuse. Right, so there's all this cloud of things that happened to her that, oof, this is not so good. So she had this dream. I'll tell you about this dream. So she dreamt that she was out in a field with her sister. And this invisible boy, who was like a ghost. Her mother wanted a boy, not her. So she's out in this sort of pasture-like field with her sister and this boy. And two holes opened up in the landscape. And the older daughter got to pick the first hole. You look through the hole, there was like a landscape that was even more beautiful. It was like a paradise. She got to put her arm in that hole. And then another hole opened up, and there was a pretty good landscape in there, too. So the invisible ghost boy got to put his arm in that one. And then the third hole opened up, and behind that, there was like a hellish landscape. And she got to put her arm in that one. And that's right. That's exactly right. That's what happened to her whole life, eh? Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because she has her mother and her sister, and she loves them, right? Because they're her mother and her sister, and they're kind of all she's got. And so, but then she hasn't had a very good time with them. And so it's not so easy to decide that someone that you love and need has also more or less consciously ground you up for 40 years, right? You can see how that might produce a bit of stress, that realization. And so she finally put the word to it. She said it was like the UN deciding what happened in Rwanda was genocide. It wasn't genocide till they said it was genocide. It was just a bunch of people killing each other. As soon as you name it, well, then the whole situation changes. So she named it, and then she said, well, now what do I do? I have to redo all my memories. Right? Because yesterday I didn't have the memories of someone who was abused. And now I have the memories of someone that was abused, so I have to fix all those memories and reinterpret them, because she thought she was just crazy. I kept talking to her, and I thought, this girl is not as crazy as people think. She's of someone who was abused, and now I have the memories of someone that was abused, so I have to fix all those memories and reinterpret them, because she thought she was just crazy. I kept talking to her, and I thought, this girl is not as crazy as people think. I mean, she was a real pain in the neck because she behaved so badly, and it's no wonder. But fundamentally, she wasn't that crazy. And the more I got to know her, the more I thought, man, if I was here, I'd be crazy too. So, and then she had to reconceptualize herself in the present, because instead of thinking that she's been mentally ill since she was 10, she started to have to think that, well, no, not. She was more like the victim of this sort of evil conspiracy. And then she has to reconceptualize her future. And so she's just, I don't know if she can handle it. And that's this background chaos. And people live in that. It's what you have to make sense out of. And the way that people deceive themselves is that, let's see here, they live within these little interpretive structures that we put on the world all the time. They're little motivated structures. And they give you a viewpoint and a reference point. But they're not complete because you're ignorant and you don't know what the hell you're doing. So you're always making up these incomplete stories about how the world is. And what surrounds those incomplete stories is this massive realm of possibility that's frightening. And the possibility is all the other ways that you could think about how you are. And that's a lot of ways. It's all the other ways the world could be if you acted in a different manner. It's all the ways the world could be if other people acted in a different manner. That's what reality is. You know, we think of reality as a collection of objects with their own trajectories, and that's not right. And we even know it, because when we think about the future, we think about a realm of unconstructed possibility that we can manipulate and change in multiple directions. And that's this melodic chaos that surrounds people. And we don't think that way. But we act that way. Because everybody knows that the future's in front of them, that they can move in it one way or another, and that things are malleable to an infinite degree. That's why you're all interested in Buddhism. Reality is an illusion. What does that mean? It means you put an interpretive framework on the world. Great. It could be otherwise. In fact, it could be infinitely otherwise. And that's terrifying. Now, if something happens to you and it shows that you're wrong, what you experience is not a stimuli. It's an indeterminate set of affairs. And you have to interact with that indeterminate set of affairs like this. You have to interact with that indeterminate set of affairs to extract from it you and the world. Right? Because the way that you make you and the world is by encountering things that you don't understand that could be a whole bunch of different ways, and by making them into the way that you want them to be. At the same time you're doing that, you're building up your own strength and capacity. It's always been that way, but we don't think of things that way. And the worst thing that you can possibly do, and the thing that will doom you and the people around you to psychopathology, is to not do it. And that's not an act of commission. You can be completely pathological and useless, and worse than that, like, because that's just where things start, merely by not acting on your own knowledge. And that's not repression either. Freud had that wrong, because Freud had a wrong model of memory. He thought people stored like a video representation of everything that happened to them, and if it was unpleasant, they suppressed it. That isn't how it works. If something really unpleasant happens to you, you don't know what happened. You have no idea what happened. It's not nameable. Because if it's really terrible, it's so far outside your domain of experience that you can't make sense of it. Your underlying biological systems say, oh my God, you know, something completely otherworldly just occurred. And that's unbelievably stressful for people, but to make that into a world takes a tremendous amount of effort. And the way people deceive themselves, most particularly, is they leave what they know they're ignorant about unexamined. And this is very complicated because, you see, imagine this. Imagine you're trying to understand the nature of the category of the things that you don't understand. It's a very weird category, right? And you can think about that as potential. That's one way of looking at it, or it is chaos. There's all sorts of things that happen to you that you do not understand. Okay, I want to close with one thing. Here's a way of conceptualizing the relationship between psychopathology and illness, or between mental functioning and illness. Now, throughout your entire life, there's been things you understand and things you didn't understand. And some of those things you didn't understand hurt you. And some of them you investigated and you learned from and you made sure that they wouldn't happen again. And some of them you did nothing with. And that's the case in the past. And maybe that's the case in the present. So you can imagine back in your bedroom at home, there's five things you should have done that you hadn't, that you haven't. And so when you walk into that room, you get all nervous because the things that you haven't done yell at you because you haven't done them. And what they yell is, here's a bunch of negative possible worlds ready to emerge that you're ignoring. And if you ignore them, then they'll emerge. So don't pay your taxes and see what sort of world emerges. And you think, well, that's a piece of paper when you look at it. But it's not a piece of paper. It's a It's a bunch of potential nasty worlds that are lying on your desk, and they're likely to manifest themselves unless you do something about it. And your brain is smart enough to know that, even though your eyes can't see it. And you walk into your room, you won't look at your damn desk because it's covered with crap that you won't look at. And the more your life is like that, the more stress you have. So imagine, and I think this is how it works. I think the amygdala, which tags things with fear, has access to the memory of the things you don't understand. And all it says is, something went wrong here. And maybe you have 1,000 of those things in your memory. Something went wrong here. And that's a memory that you remember that hurts you when you remember it. And then there's another part of your brain that says, here's things that happened to me that I understand. And then there's a ratio. Things you haven't dealt with to things you have dealt with. The higher the ratio, the more cortisol your hypothalamus puts out, because your brain assumes that you don't know what the hell you're doing or where you are. And because you don't know, you should be in a state of emergency preparation. And that's, if you're in that state long enough, you will be one sick pup. And it might be mentally ill, depending on whatever your propensity is, but it could just as easily be physically ill. And let's see. And I don't think that matters, and this is what the research indicates too. I don't think that matters if the unknown material is in your past, that's painful memories, or if it's in your present, that's things you know you're avoiding, or if it's in your future, which is a place you're terrified of because you don't know what to do with it. And insofar as all of that territory that you inhabit from the past to the future is unexplored and chaotic, then your brain is going to be in an emergency state and it's going to make you ill. And if you're in a family like that, and lots of families are like that, right? They never fight. Nothing's ever wrong. They never discuss a problem. I had a client tell me last night. I'll tell you two stories, and then I'll quit. Client told me last night, she was a Sikh woman. She knew a woman who'd been married for 65 years. 20 minutes before she died, she told her husband that he had made her life a living hell and that she'd be nothing but a slave. And she figured that my client believed that she waited till she knew she was going to die to say that. So then, and my wife worked in the palliative care ward, and she was in there with a guy who was dying of cancer. And his wife used to come in and clip his nails about 1/8 of an inch too short. Right, and this happens all the time. And the reason this happens to people is because they leave their lives cluttered messes, and they don't take the chaos that they know is there and go through the work to turn it into something pristine and functional. And it does them in. And we never see any, we don't see any recognition of this sort of thing in any of our psychotherapeutic, especially our psychotherapeutic models of causality. You know, because, and I think it's because we're not willing to take the ethical bull by the horns and understand that human health is a matter of moral action, perhaps more than it is a matter of anything else. And I'm not, I think the reason that we don't want to admit to that or even to discuss it generally is because I don't think people want to think of their own lives in that manner, because it would burden them with too much responsibility. And so I think all the coverage, the sort of pseudo-scientific objective claptrap that goes along with much of our diagnostic strategizing is a form of sin of omission, designed to shield us from what it is that we're doing that actually makes people sick. All right, well, that's good enough.
States, okay, like schizophrenia or epileptic hallucination, right, that we define as psychopathology to the previous cultures, like shamanic cultures, have defined in a privileged way.
Every culture is afraid of its own taboos, you know, and so that's one of ours.
We're not going to, I think the reason that we don't like states like that is because they're capable of showing us that things aren't the way we think they are. And people don't like that. You know, I mean, one of the big mysteries, for example, when Galileo was around,
when Galileo was around, hypothetically, the Catholic Church didn't like the idea that, you know, his idea, for example, that there were mountains on the moon, because the moon was supposed to be round and perfect. That's, most of that's overstated in a kind of peculiar interpretation of history, but it doesn't matter. When Michelangelo was alive, you couldn't dissect people. You know, and you can see why. It's a kind of a scary thing. In the 1960s, we couldn't study hallucinogenic drugs. Why? No one has a bloody clue about them. You know, it's starting up again now. There was a study done 2 years ago on psilocybin mushrooms at Johns Hopkins. But no, we don't like that sort of thing because it shows us there, all those states, those altered states, are pathways in some sense to a world that's nothing like the way we think the world is. And so we're so terrified of that, it's illegal. So that's, you know, that's that as far as I can tell. And, you know, we're starting to understand the neurobiology of those states as well. I mean, that's one thing that's lovely about neurobiology is it clumps away in ways that can't be suppressed because it's so complicated, it's hard to make it illegal. So.
You mentioned those personifications of the devil's senses. I saw envy there, the Leviathan?
Yeah, well, you know, these demonic figures were shapeshifters, right? They're all like manifestations of the same underlying thing. And so, you know, they'll be assigned one set of attributes by one thinker and another set by another. The real point is that there's, you know, sort of a king of evil in this sense, which would be the archetype of evil, which is something like pride and arrogance combined with deceit. It's as the generator of all evils. And then there's subtypes of evil, you know, and that's sort of what they were getting at here. It's like a heaven. It's like a, it's a hierarchy in a sense of action patterns that's given kind of a quasi-divine status.
Mm. So why
well, sometimes people think of chaos as demonic. No wonder, eh? Because if it comes up from underneath and swallows you, you know, even if you might come out the other end, like Jonah, that doesn't mean it doesn't look like a monster when it swallows you, right? And anything monstrous is easily made demonic. So separating chaos from evil is no easy matter. It's no easy matter for modern people, right? Although I think the separation, you know, can and should be made. He blackmailed 11-year-old girls into performing degrading sexual acts on the internet. The monster category is he's a predatory reptile.
But we're distancing, right? So that we don't
have to
explore that.
Yeah, and no kidding. Right? Do you want to relate to it? No, I'm serious. Like, I mean, exactly. Look, if you look at most mythological representations of that kind of understanding, even if it's a divine thing that manages the understanding is almost always associated with the destruction of consciousness, at least of some element of consciousness. So that's partly why people shrink from it. It's like, it's not that easy to define what's human. Look, you could say, let's say you get angry. Well, that's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is anger gets you. Now, modern people think they get angry. Archaic people, they're smarter. They didn't think that. They thought anger got you. And it was a form of possession. And so you shake out of it and you think, wow, that was me? It's like, well, yes and no. Because anger isn't you, because you shake out of it and you think, wow, that was me? It's like, well, yes and no, because anger isn't you, because you can get angry and you can get angry and you can, and so can your dog. And so, you know, anger isn't you, even though it might manifest itself inside you. The way archaic people dealt with that is they just turn that into a transpersonal deity, right? It's a personality force that exists eternally that manifests itself in each individual. It's a much more intelligent conception. So it's more intelligent because the phenomenology is right. It's a personality. Even though it's, you know, it's limited, it's not human, so it's soulless in a way. But it's a personality. So, and it plays with people. Right? The Greeks knew that. That's their tragic sense of life. Human beings are the playthings of the gods. Well, maybe you don't have to be, but generally that's the case. Good question. Good question. You know, some people are so possessed, say, by anger, that's pretty much all that's there. Stay away from those people. Right? So, but, you know, part of, one way you can think about it is that you can think of yourself as a hierarchy. Oh, I had a good picture of that. The personality development tends towards a hierarchy with something at the top. And it's hard to tell even if the thing at the top is you. It's more like the whole structure is you. The thing at the top is at least mostly what you'd experience as you. It's like your capacity for conscious awareness, your capacity to transform yourself, because that's partly what consciousness does, right? You're not that conscious of things you know how to do. You tend to be conscious of things you don't know how to do. And so, and that's sort of what you identify with because you're aware and moving. So, but what a person is, that's a really, really, really complicated question. So, one of the things Jung said, for example, is that, you know, we don't have a philosophy or even a theology that encompasses what a human being is. We're too complicated. We don't understand ourselves. So, well, it's, yeah, sorry, no, go ahead. Yeah, well, this is, what's out there is complicated. So, for example, here's an example. On Puritan churches, there used to be this big eye, and that was the eye of God. Now, we found out there's a study done recently by psychologists that showed if you took undergraduates into a lab and you sort of, you know, motivated them to cheat, if there was a picture of someone staring at them on the wall, they're much less likely to cheat, which is real cool, eh? I think that's, but that eye, here's what I think the eye is. The eye is the symbolic representation of the judgment of the dominance hierarchy. And the dominance hierarchy, you might say, well, is that eye really out there? Well, it depends what you mean by out there. Dominance hierarchies have been around at least since crustaceans emerged. And that's 300 million years. And so the dominance hierarchy has had its eye on your ancestors for 300 million years. So it's probably out there. It's just that we're so materialistic and atomistic that we can't even see what we can't see. Like we're blind to our own ignorance in a sense. It's more, I think it's more a matter of not being able to correct them, not being willing to correct them once you pick up on them. You just keep doing the same, what's the definition of insanity? You know, the old joke. It's doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Right? But even that's complicated because, you know, your parents are going to say, be persistent. Well, be persistent means keep doing the same thing over and over even though it isn't working. So these things, you know, these things are very, very complicated. There's no underlying algorithm that you can use to sort them out. So,
we have two more questions. To deal with the problem of ignorance and self-dimension, I thought about, you know, education system as a place to start.
Sorry, you thought of?
The education system?
Yeah. Well, the fundamental impediment, you know, one of the things I noticed 10 years ago was that we didn't ever have our students in university make a plan for the future and justify it. There's no course that's plan your future and justify it. You know, because maybe you might think that'd be worth 40 hours of concentrated effort instead of just being an afterthought. And the more I thought about that, the more I thought, Jesus, that's weird. Why would that be? Like, we bring people into university, they're sort of the cream of the academic crop. They write a history essay, it gets critiqued. But no one says, here's what I want to do with my life and why. And no one comes and says, well, this is stupid and maybe you should think about this. And, you know, like, think about it for God's sake. It's your life. And the more I thought about that, the weirder it got. So then I looked at the history of the education system in North America. And I found out that the elementary schools, pre-university, were set up in Chicago in the late 1800s by fascists. Really? This is before World War II, so being a fascist wasn't, you know, associated with murderous genocide by that point. But they were set up to make the children of workers obedient. Well, workers get told what to do by other people. So that's been there for 100 years. No one's noticed, which seems pretty weird. And it's even weirder in universities because theoretically you're being taught to be an individual, like a citizen in universities. But no one does that. And I think that's because people don't want to take... I think it's this responsibility issue again. It's like, it's so daunting that we just don't pay attention to it. And so, you know, part of what I do is to make people do that. It's like, think about who you are. Think about the fact that if you don't get your act together, you will be one dangerous son of a bitch. Like one horrible, nasty creature. And you'll create untold harm. And don't do that. Set your life up so you're not inclined to do that. And think about it. And be aware that you are like that, even though you don't want to think you are. Right? Because no one wants to think they're a Nazi. But everybody is one. So, look, 90, you know, it was 95% participation in Germany. And, like, the only thing that distinguishes, you know, the average person from Hitler is that Hitler was an organizational genius. That's the distinction. It's not the bloody motivation. It's the ability. There's no shortage of tyrants in families. It's probably the rule. And there's no shortage of tyrants as leaders. It's probably the rule. So since it's the rule, it probably applies to you. And if you're not a tyrant, you're probably a victim. So you can pick your category. Well, I am trying to do that. You know, I mean, I did this goal-setting program with students at McGill who were academically struggling, and that seemed to work. And, you know, we're trying to sort of commercialize that and see if we can move it around. The commercialization seems to be a necessary prerequisite to getting anything taken seriously. Like, you can't give things away for nothing because that just doesn't work. So, but mostly what I'm trying to do is talk to you guys like I'm talking today, and I, you know, do my courses, and that seems to help. And people, you know, the response is positive, which is weird. Like, I've thought for 20 years that I'm going to get fired, but never happens. So good, you know, it's surprising. So...